Michael Cathcart on RN. This is Books and Arts, coming to you from the Perth Writers' Festival. No, I didn't prep that audience. They just clap like that because they love us all. Over the next hour, you and I will get to know Elizabeth Gilbert. She's the author of one of the great novels of the last decade, The Signature of All Things, which is the story of a brilliant young woman named Alma, who grows up in Philadelphia in the first half of the 19th century and develops a passion for moss. And by the end of the novel, she's pretty much worked out the theory of evolution, but not before she's broken free of the golden cage in which she's been confined and headed off to Tahiti to explore new frontiers. Elizabeth Gilbert is also the author of one of the best-selling books of recent times. Her memoir, Eat, Pray, Love, is about her own voyages of exploration in search of meaning and love, and it's sold more than 10 million copies. Liz, welcome to the program. Nice to be here.
Thank you.
Is this a lovely festival?
It is. I was admiring how, you know, literary people are so sedate. When this audience erupted into cheers, I thought, I love the sort of rock festival quality of this audience. That's my kind of literary people, like little muscle behind their passion. I like it.
Let's talk about the book, The Signature of All Things. It's your sixth book. It's your second novel. And it tells the story of Alma Whittaker. I love this, born with the century. That is such a genius idea. In the winter of 1800 in Philadelphia. Can you just briefly recall this world that she's been born into?
Sure. Alma is born into a young America, just recently independent, and she's born into people who are new Americans. Her father is a British immigrant. Her mother is a Dutch immigrant. Her father is a... all of her family are brilliant botanists. Her father is a botanical and pharmaceutical entrepreneur who was born into humble people in England and then went off on Cook's final journey as a sort of apprentice botanist, and then on his own discovered some of the most potent quinine in the world down in Peru, made a fortune out of it, and moved to America to become a magnate, really, and to sort of launch the pharmaceutical industry, which was, in fact, launched in Philadelphia around that time. And her mother is a brilliant, educated Dutch woman whose family runs the botanical gardens in Amsterdam. So she's born into this world that's both rough, because it's post-colonial sort of new and evolving city, and also intellectually incredibly sophisticated, and speaks and reads five languages by the age of 10, and is born steeped in plants.
It's also a paradoxical world because, as you've explained, her father has this global reach. It's part of globalization, the dawn of globalization, you could argue, I think. But her life, her own life, is so hemmed in.
She has a very large, small life. She has access to the greatest library in the New World, which is in her father's possession. He's not an intellectual, but he's intellectually competitive, and so he's been collecting books, and he has a beautiful library, which she can read. He can't, but she can. So her mind is unfettered, but her geography is tiny. She lives on her father's estate. She's sort of his secretary, his helpmeet, his companion. She's very close with her father. And the whole world is open to her in every way except for literally. her world doesn't really extend geographically beyond the walls of the family's estate.
It struck me as I was reading the book that she's really not given to self-pity. I mean, why would she? She's a wealthy girl with all these books to read. But she does feel terribly confined, terribly withheld from the wider world. But it's not a book, or she doesn't have a mindset that constructs this as though this is a silencing of all women. It's not as if she's in solidarity with women. I guess what I'm saying to you, it's not actually a kind of feminist story you're telling.
It's a stealth feminist novel. Because, first of all, I'm never going to be able to write anything that's not some sort of a feminist track, just because of where I sort of stand in my own bones. But what I didn't want to do was to bring a contemporary feminist sensibility to a novel with a woman who never would have heard of those ideas. And Alma would not have heard of those ideas. Now, when she was older, in the middle of the 19th century, she could very well have feasibly joined in with a debate that was going on in the United States about questions of women's autonomy and women's rights. But she wasn't a socially minded person. She was a scientifically minded person. And so I wanted her to have that sort of narrow, myopic view that a lot of scientific people have, where they're just so focused in on the thing that they're passionate about that they kind of, you know, almost like on the spectrum, don't really notice what's going on in people's emotional lives around them or in society as a whole. So in that way, she's very much a pure scientist. The feminist aspect of it is simply that she's a woman with a tremendous mind who ends up charting her own course, but doesn't do it on behalf of general holding a flag for all of womanhood, does it because she's following her own curiosities.
You draw a nice distinction between botany and polite botany. Would you talk to that?
Yeah, I almost called the book Polite Botany because when I heard of Polite Botany, it made me laugh so hard. So the thing is that in the 19th century, and the reason that I chose botany to be Alma's, this the sort of expression of her intellect, was that the only science that women could even a little bit participate in was botany, because flowers, plants, you know, it was considered not entirely unfeminine. So chemistry was not open to women, and physics and mathematics and these sorts of things, but botany was somewhat. And in fact, they sort of dominated botany for the first half of the 19th century until science became more professionalized and more legitimized by university degrees, and men sort of took it over. And there was this very articulated fear that men had that there was a guy who was the president of London College who said when he took over his tenure, we have to rescue the noble science of botany from women because it's a science, you know, so we can't let them do it. And in fact, up until that point, they'd been doing it quite well and had been making lots of contributions and publishing papers, and they were the best botanical illustrators, and they're really part of this. And so the way that that men's delicate egos were protected around this was that what happened is that it got divided into two branches. There was botany, which is what men did, and there was polite botany, which is what women did. And polite botany was really no different from botany. It was just a way of making sure that you didn't accidentally think you were a legitimate scientist if you were a woman. And so Alma was a polite botanist in every way except for her.
Now, it's an historical novel, and as I said, I think it's one of the great books of the last few years. I loved reading it. When I read a historical novel, I often find myself disoriented because I don't quite know what the truth claims are that are being made by this particular book. I really, because I'm a historian, I guess, I really like to know about the past. And if the book is sort of a bit made up, then I really don't know what I'm learning. I don't know what to file away as, oh, that's interesting. That's an interesting fact about that period.
Yeah.
Do you share that sense of being sometimes wrong-footed by historical fiction?
Yeah, I understand your question. And it's a, you know, we were just discussing Hilary Mantel, and I know that there are certain historians who really get their hackles up about her because where does she get off putting conversation in historical figures' mouths? It confuses people and muddies the water, and they don't like it, and it puts out wrong information, and they get fussy. I think a novel can do that. You know, I think that's why it gets to be a novel, is that you can kind of do whatever you like. But what I wanted to do with this one was I did 3 years of research in order to make sure that everything in there was plausible, that even things that had not happened could have happened. And I didn't mess with... Oh, yes, I did mess with history, because I had Alfred Russel Wallace is the only character. Yeah, I kind of did mess with it. He shows up as an actual character in the book, goes on a trip he didn't actually go on to Holland, and meets my Alma at the end of his life. But I like to think that they could have had that conversation. And the conversation that I put in his mouth came from his writings and came from what I knew to be his... I didn't put any opinions in his mouth that were not his own. And so I felt a sort of loyalty to him to make sure that I didn't make him say anything that I didn't think he would have said.
Did you think through what your contract with the reader was as you were writing the book?
The contract with the reader is that the highest contract is to delight, I think. So we begin with that. And so the amount of history that I put in there and the amount of facts that I put in there and the amount of science that I put in there, I've tried to have it be the right amount that it will convey what's going on without boring you, because I don't think we should bore each other. Yes. On purpose. I really try hard not to, and I know that sometimes in the arts, especially contemporarily, I think sometimes people forget that mandate, that the original mandate of the arts, I think, is to delight and to transport. So that's my first order of business. That comes first, and then everything else after.
Some historians, I reckon, like to emphasize continuities with the past. They go to the past and they think, oh, they're so like us. Uh-huh. You know, they cared for their children, they wondered about death, they wanted fulfillment in life. And other people go to the past and think, oh, gosh, they're so strange. You know, the Victorians, they're obsessed with things we're not obsessed with. The Egyptians, wow, what a weird cosmology they had. Do you find yourself more like one or other of those? Do you find the past strange and interesting for those reasons? Or do you keep meeting people you recognize?
I don't find people in the past to be any more familiar and more weird than people in the present, right? I think that's the essence of the strangeness of humanity. Even in this room, if I were to talk to any of you, there would be moments where I would think, wow, you and I have so much in common.
This is a room of very strange people.
And then, shortly on the heels of that, I would think, you are a space alien to me.
Yeah.
I have no idea how you are even functioning. We are so different. And that's the same now as then. I think, for me, the intimacy that I discovered when I was doing the research was through reading letters. That's how those people became real to me. Because letters are such a gift, because it's the closest we can get to actually listening in on sort of a phone conversation, where you can hear people's voices, especially super literate people in the 19th century who used the post the way we use email and who were sending out, you know, 60 letters a day through 4 posts a day. So you would get your morning mail and then you would respond and send something back in the afternoon mail, and they would respond, and you'd send something back in the evening mail. And those people, even when they were great, dignified people who were aware of their legacy, they didn't have time to be guarding their legacy in every word that they wrote in their letters. And so there's a vulnerability in which they reveal their anger, their frustration, their longing, how tired they are, their toothache. And you get the sense of that person in a really wonderful way. And I don't think I could have invented these characters had I not read so many letters.
This is Books and Arts on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart, coming to you today from the Perth Writers' Festival, where my guest is the American author Elizabeth Gilbert, and we're talking about her most recent novel, The Signature of All Things. So these letters, where did you find them?
They're everywhere. There's volumes and volumes and volumes, and I read Darwin's letters, and I read Alfred Russel Wallace's letters, and I read the letters of a lot of polite botanists. But I also read more widely searching. I read Abigail Adams' letters, and I read the letters of, there's one of the greatest resources that there is at the Philadelphia Historical Society, the journals and letters of this just housewife, late 18th century, early 19th century housewife, who lived in Germantown in Pennsylvania, and who documented her life quite accurately, and for 40 or 50 years, and wasn't a figure, wasn't a public figure, was just somebody who took the time every day to sort of write a couple words about what was going on. And she was just a treasure trove about what a average day would be like for somebody in this time. I'm probably the millionth person to go read her stuff, because anybody who writes about Philadelphia historically has to find her, whose name I cannot not remember.
Now, there you are in the archive, or there you are reading all these books, and presumably you're taking notes. Now, the person who's doing historical research always faces this next problem. That is, all your notes are in the order that you read them. They're not in the order that they need to be for you to create a book. So the next thing you need to do is create some kind of machinery for organising your material so you can deploy it effectively for the book. Otherwise, you spend all your life going back through your notes trying to find it was where you wrote, you know, took the notes of that letter that was so brilliant but which you haven't seen for 3 years. So you presumably created some kind of machinery for organizing your research.
I have such a beautiful machine that was taught to me when I was 14 by my ninth grade social studies and Western civilization teacher, Mr. John Kisco, whose machine I have used ever since. I used it all through university. I've used it for every book I've ever written. It's shoeboxes and index cards. And it's such a beautiful system, because you create subjects. So rather than things being in the order that you research them, as you're writing notes, you write them on your index card, and then you drop it into its subject heading. Or into, if it's a novel, I have a little file for each character. So if I'm reading somebody's letters and I come upon some beautiful turn of phrase and I think, oh, this would be something wonderful for Hanukkah de Groot, the housewife, to say, I write it on the index card and I drop it into her file. Or if I'm studying mosses or evolution or the abolition movement or the rights of women or Tahiti or missionaries, I've got all these different sections. And then what you get is kind of a book in a box, or in this case, five boxes. And then you put them in the order of the narrative, and then you just write by numbers.
Yeah. You just join them up.
You just string them together.
I know.
You just tape those index cards together. You got yourself a book.
That's it. But that is
so easy.
So let's share the key secret of this method, Liz, because what you have to discipline yourself as a writer to do is, if on one page there are three different fact units, you've got to break those up. You've got to shatter the page. Each one goes on its own card.
Yep.
Because the first fact unit's going to go into that category, the second's going to go there, and the second's going to go there and may not ever get used.
Yeah.
But you've got to discipline yourself to say, those are the three elements I need to fracture and place into their separate place in the box.
All art is collage, right?
Yeah.
And so that's really essentially what you're doing, is you're chopping up thousands and thousands of bits of things, and then you're mixing them with your own history and with your own imagination. You're putting a bunch of glue on it, and then you're making a sort of a mosaic that's your own, and then it gets to be yours.
Yeah, put the framework up before you try to build the house. So many people start to write out of their research. Do you also write every day anyway after you've done? No. So you collect all the material and then sit down and kind of write it, too?
I write in seasons. And I'll say that if anybody out there is an aspiring writer, as everybody is and should be, and I do always encourage aspiring writers, I would say if you're at that level, you should be writing every day, because nobody else will make you do it. You have no incentive to do it. Nobody's waiting for it. If you're unknown, no editor is knocking on the door saying there's a deadline. You have to create your own deadlines, your own motivation, your own structure in your own time. And I did that when I was an unpublished young writer. But now at this point, the way that I've evolved as a writer is that it's seasonal labor for me. And there are seasons for research, and there are seasons for publicity, as we're doing right now once the book is finished. There are seasons for writing, there are seasons for editing, there are seasons to pause, And so now it goes on a cycle, and right now I'm just beginning the season of research for the next thing. But I don't try to muddy my head and also it's pointless, and it's kind of a waste of time for me to write every day if I don't have a thing to write yet. I need to go collect a lot of information before I can actually put it together. And I'd rather have all that done and then sit down and do the whole thing at once.
I have a different experience from that, because I find that when I'm doing research, I have these blazes of insight that I know I will not recover, that will not be reactivated when I read the card again. And I want to capture that research moment.
Then you take your index card and you write that paragraph on the index card.
On the card,
and
yes.
You put it in your shoebox.
That's what I do.
And then you say, this is a little present for you, future Michael. And then future Michael's writing his book, and he finds that index card with that blazing piece of glory on it. He goes, thank you, past Michael.
You
and
do.
There's like a little salute across time.
That's it.
It's a little nice gift you give to yourself. It's nice.
And when you write it, you think, this is such crap. And when you find it 2 years later, you think, whoa, that's good.
Yeah, hello. And then you feel like you had little magical elves helping you, but it was just your older self
doing
it. It's a little, it's like a little gift, a little present you throw ahead in time for yourself.
Now, you mentioned Captain Cook. And before the book came out and the sort of pre-publicity for it, there was a lot of play made of Captain Cook. So I was expecting a big kind of Captain Cook narrative. There was a YouTube with you holding a lovely version of Captain Cook.
Yeah.
And Captain Cook went in a flash when I read the book. What was it about Captain Cook that was so galvanizing for you?
Well, he's really a walk-in character in this book. And I feel like he has to, because I do have this objection. Unless you're Hilary Mantel, unless you are like truly a genius as a reader of historical fiction, I would prefer not to have and here's Abraham Lincoln walking into the room. I like the minor characters of history better, because I feel like I don't know them well enough to feel jarred by their presence in a novel. So to me, Captain Cook's a little bit like George Washington. It would just be really weird to have him so he doesn't actually even have a line in this book. He's a figure and a presence. Joseph Banks is a character who shows up and gets dialogue, because he's less, I don't know, less epically known in a way. And I also felt like I knew him better, because he revealed himself more in his letters and journals than stern, rigid Mr. Cook did. So what was interesting about them? They were the great Enlightenment explorers slash scientists. They were at this very privileged and precious moment of history, and they knew they were. They were different from anybody who had ever come before them. We can look back at them now and shudder at their racism and their ignorance and their arrogance, but they were a lot less racist, a lot less ignorant, and a lot less arrogant than any of the Europeans who came before them. They actually were interested in the world, not just to conquer, not just to bring Christianity, not just to take everything, but they were engaged. They thought it was a fascinating place. They thought the people in it were fascinating. They didn't want to kill everybody they met. They wanted to study everybody they met. And they were fascinating to me for that.
One of the qualities of the book I really loved is the way in which you treat the Enlightenment as though it's a sort of government or a bureaucracy with many departments. So you've got Henry representing mercantile ambition, mm-hmm. I guess. You've got Alma, who's this young woman who's got the kind of scientific drive and the skepticism and the spirit of inquiry that we think of as the great quality of the Enlightenment. You've just talked about the explorers and their contribution to it. Do you think of us as still living in the Enlightenment era?
No. Which is not to say that we're living in something else. We're living in the post-Darwin era, which is where... the other interesting thing about the Age of Enlightenment was that it was the last moment in history where a man could, or a woman, but more a man probably likely, let's be honest, could... without any cynicism, say that they were a man of science, a man of God, and a man of the arts, and a man of commerce all at the same time. There was no division between all of those things. Darwin almost became a minister. You know, the way that people found divinity was in nature. The great scientists of that time believed that they were doing God's work by studying the natural world.
Well, the word scientist itself doesn't come into the language until the
1830s, yeah. And there was a lot of debate and anger about that word because it, interestingly, and I would say presciently, there were people who hated that word. I mean, up until then, you were a natural philosopher. But they felt they needed some other word, some other more modern word, and they came up with this word scientist. And there were people who hated it because they said, it sounds an awful lot like atheist. And lo, eventually it would, right? And so you could feel already this tension was happening where science and religion were already, it wasn't working anymore, you know? And I feel like that was that last moment where all of those strands were braided together. Arts, science, and religion were all the same thing. And then they fractured, and they've been fractured ever since. And I feel as though there's been something lost. There's been something gained in that, but there's also been something lost in that. You know, my sense of it now is that we live in this world full of scientists who have lost all sense of faith and reverence, and the reverent who have lost all reason, and artists who've lost both, right? And there, it's almost as though something's going to have to happen at some point to re-thread that, because those are the sort of really important central themes of an intellectual and spiritual mind is a thirst for divinity, a thirst for knowledge, and a thirst for beauty. And when you divide them, I think you punish the society that has that division.
I'd add another thirst, and that is the thirst to communicate. Because it seems to me that over the last 100 years, many artists, especially artists who saw themselves as being in the artistic elite, didn't have a strong desire to communicate. The number of writers and artists I've spoken to over the years who've said, oh, I don't think about my audience.
Ugh.
I think, well, why the hell not? I mean, they're going to buy your work. This idea that they're just going to overhear you enraptured in your own solipsistic genius, and then we'll get the kind of reverberations that came out of that intense encounter you're having. I think, oh, please, just... You can sit in your...
You're like, keep it in your pants, buddy, please. You know, really, I mean, that's sort of what it feels like. You're like, and I think, not you, I just...
That just makes it worse.
but there is something genuinely inhumane about some of the direction that the arts have taken in that... And I get it, because I feel like they were pushing into a new exploratory where they wanted to be freed of the obligations to each other. I get that that's something to try and something to experiment with. And certainly in the middle of the last century, I think, was the epitome of that, where people are writing music with no melody, they're making stories with no narrative, and they're making art with no figures in it, mm-hmm. right? And basically the public said, yeah, we hate all of that. And they're making architecture that's brutalist. They're trying to leave you out, you know? And I think that people went about as far as you can go with that, and I feel like what I'm seeing is a return to the humanities, a return to the idea that it's better if this is for somebody. It's better, you know, some of these aesthetic forms that have been around forever have been around forever because we like them, because we like being told a story. We like melody. We have things in our brain that respond to that. We like symmetry. We like pleasing colors. We, you know, and it's not because we're mundane. It's because we share a common human aesthetic. And I think to be aware of that is to be a more humane artist.
Yes, I do feel like... Oh. I do feel the tide is turning on that. This is Books and Arts on RN, and you and I are at the Perth Writers' Festival with the American novelist Elizabeth Gilbert, and we're talking about all sorts of things, including her most recent novel, The Signature of All Things. Attitudes to race are a key idea in the book, and I haven't read much reflection on what you've got to say about race, but race does come into what's going on. Can you talk a bit about that?
It had to, because you can't write about 19th century America without writing about it. Actually, you kind of can't write about America without writing about it, but certainly 19th century America and certainly Philadelphia. I mean, I set the novel in Philadelphia because Philadelphia was the scientific and commercial center of the country, and it was the botanical center of the country. Interestingly, because of Quakers, the reason that Philadelphia became the pharmaceutical capital was because of Quakers' pacifism, you couldn't make a career as a young Quaker man in the military, and it wasn't really considered very moral or ethical to make your name in law, and so they all became doctors and pharmacists. So there was this heavy sort of pharmaceutical and medical weight in Philadelphia, but it was also because of Quakers the beginning of the abolition movement, and there was no way that I could have characters who were engaging with Quaker pharmacists and Quaker values without starting to bring up abolition. What I found fascinating was that, and I mean this as no offense to any vegans in the audience, early 19th century American abolitionists were regarded by the rest of the population as basically being like vegans. They were really annoying. You know, we sort of knew they were right. Like, people knew they were right, but they didn't want to hear it. And they were just righteous, and there was this real sense that even among people who were anti-slavery, which was most people in Philadelphia, they just felt like, could somebody just shut the abolitionists up? Because they're just irritating. And I hadn't known that that was the case. People who were abolitionists before it was hip, you know, like in 1810. It's pretty early to be an abolitionist when slavery went on for another 60 years, 50 years. So I wanted a character who embodied that sort of, you know, the most moral people. If you think of the most moral, ethical person you know, the reality is that's probably an irritating person. Even though you know they're right, you just don't want it in your face all the time, right? And so the abolitionist in this book is the most ethical and most moral person and also the most irritating. And I thought that's not a character I've seen before. Yeah.
When I was a student, I shared a house with a woman who was just like that, Spirulina. She just talked all the time about spirulina. It was going to change our lives. We all had to eat spirulina. I don't even know what spirulina is, but apparently it was going to change.
I know what it is, and it isn't pork belly. and she's right. They're right. That's the thing. They're right. But man, sometimes you just want to watch TV, you know? So I think that I found that I didn't realize that the amount of hostility that people had against abolitionists, and it wasn't people who were pro-slavery, it was just people who just didn't want morality waved in front of their face every day. But without those abolitionists, there, you know, the world would have been a very different place.
There was a wonderful scene in which Alma's beautiful sister, she has a spunky sister, silent and beautiful, takes on Professor Peck at dinner, who was expounding his theories of the supremacy of the white race, and she just dresses him down.
Yeah, that was fun to write.
That's a wonderful scene.
Yeah, and it's the first time she speaks, and in a way the last time, but she's been raised to have good manners, but she just takes him right apart, challenging him on, you know, well, because his arguments are incredibly unscientific. People have different texture of hair, and therefore they are different species. And so she brings up sheep breeding and dog and horse breeding and saying, well, you know, there's sheep that have curly hair and sheep that have straight hair, but surely they're the same species. And she sort of slowly dissembles his argument and very coolly humiliates him, which was fun.
Now, it's almost 2 years since we discussed this novel. this is when it first came out, and it was inappropriate then, I guess, to talk about the last act of the novel because it was like giving the end away. Mm. But I would love to go there because it seems to me that's when the story suddenly becomes dangerous and off the leash. So what happens is that Alma leaves the confines of this golden cage in which she's lived and goes off into the wide world. When in the writing did you realise that Alma was going to set forth and sail the seven seas?
Never was that my plan. My plan was to write, to specifically and intentionally write the opposite of Eat, Pray, Love in a way, to talk about, to say what would happen to a woman of great intellect, great curiosity, and ranging rapacious appetites who could never leave the confines of a very narrow area. How big a life could she build interiorly for that, right? That was really going to be the theme, because I feel like one of the things I'm very interested in about women's lives and women's imaginations and creativity is the way that in small scale they make big things, you know, like the incredible stitching of embroidery and the painting on teacups, the things that women do to not go insane when their lives are kept very, very, very small. They can make great acts of beauty in these little confined spaces. So the first half of the book really explores that. And then I was like, I can't take this anymore. Like, get on a freaking boat, you know? And also because as I did research, I found women who had, you know, there were some really intrepid, and I thought it was cool that she became a traveler when she was a postmenopausal spinster in her 50s, which is when a lot of these women did it. Because I think my mom always says about being in her 70s that the worst part about growing older as a woman is that you become invisible. And the best part about growing older as a woman is that you become invisible. And so my mom, who was a really gorgeous young woman, and I still think is a gorgeous older woman, but, you know, there's this thing where men just don't see her because she's a white-haired little old lady in their eyes, is now free to do whatever she wants with no sexual threat whatsoever. And so she and her sister-in-law have taken to traveling around the world to the most outrageous places, and they're perfectly safe because they're just little old ladies, you know. And I feel like Alma gets to do that, and a lot of Victorian women got to do that. After a certain age, they could sort of do whatever they wanted, so I just gave her her Eat, Pray, Love moment after all.
Now, when you say... When you say she's a spinster, technically she's
technically
not.
Not
she's not a spinster, but she's probably a virgin, I guess. But she's met a man she's 50 when she meets this man, Ambrose Pike, who is a gifted botanical artist. They get married, and she's dying to have sex. She's been thinking about sex. She's been reading about sex. She's been practicing sex in the binding closet.
Yes.
And when she finally gets into bed with this chap, he just rolls over and goes to sleep, and he explains that he just wants a spiritual...
He wants a mariage blanc. A mariage blanche, I guess, is the right way. But
a spirulina marriage.
A spirulina marriage. And he, in one of the most terrible misunderstandings, and these are the things that just are so painful in people's lives, is that our lives are filled with terrible misunderstandings. He just assumes she wants the same, because he assumes that as a sort of homely older woman, she would probably love to be relieved of the burden of sexuality. She's been dying to have sex her whole life. And I also wanted in this book to explore female unrequited desire. I feel like that's something that... we don't see a lot of in novels. There's a theme that runs throughout literature of a beautiful temptress, a female, beautiful sexualized woman who torments a man, right? Who he wants her and he can't have her. We see that in stories, and we see what that sort of torment does to a man, but we don't often see what that kind of torment does to a woman. I know firsthand what it feels like to be rejected by somebody who you desire, and it's awful. And it's just a sinking, terrible, awful thing. And I didn't want to do that to her, but I also felt like she needed to have that happen in order to become the woman who she ultimately becomes. And I also wanted to write about female disappointment. One of the messages of this book, and indeed sort of that I've learned in life, is that women can endure a tremendous amount of disappointment. And novels about women tend to not know that. You know, when you read 18th and 19th century novels about women, you would think that women all throw themselves under trains when something goes wrong, and most of us don't. Most of us kind of don't always get what we want, and we soldier on. And then the great power and fascination about women to me is the way that women take their disappointment and, using some sort of alchemy, they turn it into power, they turn it into wisdom, they turn it into perspective, and they turn it into dignity. And almost dignity at the end of the book is, I think, her most striking characteristic.
Yeah. So Ambrose Pike, she sends him off, actually. She has the power now.
She chucks him out.
Over the estate. Not just chucks him out, but sends him to Tahiti.
Sends him to the other side of the world. No hell like a woman scorned.
Are you happy to talk about why he goes there, or do you feel like we are giving away the end of the book?
Well, we've given it all away already anyway. It's okay. I mean, it's been out. If you haven't read it yet, you know, you should have.
Okay.
Okay,
so what happens is she gets, to cut a long story short, she gets a case. He's died. She gets a case, which is his stuff, and in it there are these drawings, which are clearly erotic drawings of an islander, of a black
homosexual
man.
Homosexual erotic drawings.
Yeah, yeah. And so
interracial homosexual erotic drawings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she realises there's more to sexuality and desire and to him than she ever guessed, and really she goes to Tahiti to try to figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah, she goes to track it down because the worst thing that ever happened to her, the best and worst thing that ever happened to her was this man. I mean, I submit and still submit that he loved her. He worshipped her. He adored her. He just wasn't straight. And there wasn't a place in that world for that. And so rather than being an active homosexual, which would have been very difficult, and he became an aesthete, right? He just became a monk. He put it all into God and put it all into art and thought he had found a partner, a sister. Mm. She didn't want a brother. She wanted somebody to have sex with. And so when he goes off and then he dies and then she gets all his stuff back and finds these drawings and suddenly realizes that, oh, you know that sometimes you get something that should be the worst news in the world and instead you're like, oh, that's what it was, right? But then she's also like, or was it? So she goes off to find the boy in the pictures and see if she can get some answers about who this person was in her life and what he was to her and what he was to this guy. And it's really just her trying to put together the pieces of her psyche, which, you know, is what all novels are really about.
So, Liz, you set her free. Off she goes in the last section of the novel on this great voyage. And, of course, in some ways we're back in Eat, Pray, Love territory. Is there some way in which for all this novel, after all, she's been you sort of confined?
Yeah, I mean, look, they all are, everybody in there. That's the thing about a novel is that, you know, Henry Whittaker is me. You know, in some ways more than Alma, like his ambition and his drive and his, like the sort of, his eagerness to conquer in a way is something that I know and feel. And Hanneke de Groot is me and my mother, her, you know, the maid with her pragmatism and her discipline and Retta Snow is certainly me, you know, and Ambrose is me, you know, the spiritual aspect of him. They're all sort of branches, but Alma probably most of all, just in the desire to know. She just wants to know. She just wants the answer to what's going on. Which is, of course, the hardest thing to
And
find.
Yet she doesn't have a spiritual dimension. She actually says, I've never felt the need to invent a world beyond this world, for this world has always seemed large and beautiful enough for me.
Yeah. And that way she's not on an Eat, Pray, Love journey. I had this idea that she would have some sort of a spiritual moment at the end of the book with Alfred Russel Wallace. Because Alfred Russel Wallace, I love. He's, of course, the other discoverer of evolution. It's one of those questions of simultaneous discovery where he and Darwin both came up with it at the same time, but Darwin got it a bit, tiny bit faster. But Alfred Russel Wallace did have a spiritual aspect and a scientific aspect, and a wonderful explanation for how to meld them that I thought was really moving, and that's why I wanted to bring him into the novel and have him explain that to Alma. And up until the moment I wrote that scene, I had thought that she would buy into sort of his vision, because he creates the sort of compromise where there's room for divinity and room for science. And as I was writing it, I was like, she would never, you know, and it would be a disgrace to her and a dishonor to her and to the ethic of who she was. She's not a spiritual person. She never was a spiritual person. She's somebody who finds wonder in facts, and she's empirical. And if I take that empiricism away from her at the last minute of her life, it's a bit of a dishonor.
Not just a wonder in facts, but a wonder in life.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, in the mystery of the life of moss. I mean, she's a person who doesn't need to believe in an afterlife, because the miracle of it all is that we're here now in this life. And that is more than enough. She has a bountiful here and now-ness to her.
And that, for many people, is enough, you know? And that's where I will defend atheists completely, because I feel like, I mean, there's... something spirulinally like annoying about atheists as well. Like, as I always say, I always wish I loved anything as much as atheists love talking about being atheists. But you know, what I think the highest atheistic mind is saying is, how dare you not have this be enough? Like, what is missing? Look at this world that you were given. Look at all of this wonder and marvel and beauty and mystery. And you need to create an alternative world because this doesn't do it for you? Like, it's almost, that's a sacrilege. You can feel their indignation in that. And I respect that completely. I just happen to also need to dream of imaginary worlds. So I have to go another level. But I don't think everybody does.
No, I don't. I mean, that's my position. I just wake up every morning and thinking, how can this possibly be? This is miraculous.
It's amazing. Yeah. And for most people, if that's enough for you, awesome. And if it's not, you know, you got to go on your trip.
This is Books and Arts on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart, and you and I at the Perth Writers Festival discussing miraculous things with the American writer Liz Gilbert. Now, the BBC's making a series of the book.
Yeah, apparently. I think the contracts have officially been signed, and it's the same team who does Downton Abbey, which is great. And it's the same team who are doing Wolf Hall. It's right. The same. So I'm so psyched.
So you heard it here first. This is going public for the...
Yeah,
pretty much
I guess
the first
this
time.
Is kind of a public announcement. There are many steps between a contract being signed and something actually happening. My friend Ann Patchett always says that the odds of a movie deal turning into a movie are the same as the odds of a first kiss turning into a 30-year marriage. But, you know, it can happen. You know, it's happened before. They're very keen on it, and they're thinking a four-part miniseries, which actually might be filmed in Australia. It's one of the possibilities. They're really thinking of locations. They want to do it all in one place, and they could make a fake 18th century Philadelphia here, and a fake Tahiti and a fake Holland. You can fake a lot. You got
a
lot of space.
Give you the lot. Yes.
Yeah.
Eat, Pray, Love. Now that's a book of startling candor, and you've shown your candor today. You've been wonderfully open. And in that book, you talk about your fits of rage and your despair and your hot sex and your urinary tract infections that follow the hot sex.
Oh, we're going there, are we?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you were mad at me for saying, keep it in your pants.
No, this is my revenge. Where do you reckon you got that capacity for candor from? Where does it... What's its origins?
That kind of thing is not a... it's not a choice, right? It's not like I learned how to be candid. It's really quite the opposite. I've spent my life trying to learn how to zip it up, you know, because I don't naturally have any boundaries. And that's in some ways wonderful and in other ways disastrous. And so a lot of my life has been about trying to learn the opposite, you know, that it's okay to have an unspoken thought. It's, you know... I had an ex-boyfriend who said, you have the opposite of poker face. You have, like, miniature golf face. It's all, like, it's all right there. So, most of my life is just about trying to hold it together, not about not spilling it. So it's not difficult. That's why I love when people say lovely things about Eat, Pray, Love, but the one thing that I don't quite get or feel when people say is, like, oh, what a brave thing for you to share all that. And I was like, that's not for me brave. That's just me... you know, meeting you at a bus stop and telling you everything about myself. That's just how I am. That's not courage. Courage is doing stuff that's hard for you, you know?
So you have this mega success. I mean, more success than you could possibly ever have dreamed you were going to have with this book that's basically your sort of travel journal, and it just turns into this cult thing, and deservedly so. And then you write a sequel to it, which, you know, is a sort of conspicuous failure, really.
I think we can agree that... I have the statistics because they make me laugh. I think Committed sold 1/1,000th of the copies of Eat, Pray, Love. Now, to be fair, it outsold by tons anything that came before Eat, Pray, Love, right? It's just that Eat, Pray, Love was such an outlier, you know, such a black swan that what could you do? Like, how are you going to do that? You can't do that again, you know? And for me, what felt very important... as somebody who values her sanity and values her work, was the only response after Eat, Pray, Love was to, as quickly as possible, throw something out there. Just break the spell, get it done. Whatever it's going to be, you can't, you know, I'm not going to be able to please the people who loved Eat, Pray, Love because it's not going to be Eat, Pray, Love because I can't do that again. And I'm not going to be able to please the many people who hated it because anything I did would just be a reminder that I exist and they don't want me to. And so you can't win, in which case you also kind of can't lose, right? I mean, that's the great thing about not being able to win is that that means there's no stakes. There's nothing. Just do something. Right. Just do something. And what will happen is that then my feeling on the day that Committed was published was, okay, everybody, let's just all get it out of our system now, right? Like, here's the thing, just chew on it. Everyone who needs to, whatever pent-up resentment or love or fear or whatever you've got about me and about Eat, Pray, Love, here's something for you to take it out on, and then we can all move on, right?
So it wasn't tough for you that it didn't have the mega success that the first book it had?
No, that wasn't tough for me. Writing it was tough because I felt there was so much static in the atmosphere, right? I had never written with so much attention on me before, so that part was hard. Publishing it was easy because the day that it was published was like one of the most liberating days of my life because I was like, well, I just did the hardest homework assignment of my life. I'm done. Everything after this is easy. And I had zero expectations about what it was going to do. I mean, the great thing about how outrageously successful Eat, Pray, Love was, is that it couldn't be competed with, you know? And so there's two ways to respond to that, which is to just fold up, shop, and never make anything again, or just make whatever you want, you know? So the Signature of All Things is in many ways a celebration of the great expansive freedom and liberation I felt after Committed had broken the spell of Eat, Pray, Love, because I felt like, well, now there's no stakes. You know, nobody's expecting anything from me at this point, or people have already made up their minds, so just do what you want. So it's been kind of fun ever since then.
There's something very beautiful and very mysterious, actually, about the fact that you just described Eat, Pray, Love as a black swan. Can you unpack what that expression means to you?
I'm just on a little thin ice here because I might think it means something that it doesn't mean, but no. Doesn't it mean an outlier? And it doesn't it also mean an evolutionary freakish...
Yeah, it means something that can't possibly be.
Yeah.
Now, we are...
And you have them here,
we
right?
are not only that, Liz, but we are meeting on the shores of the Swan River,
right.
Which is the first place where Europeans in the 1600s saw the black swan.
And said this cannot be.
So Captain de Vlaming, this is right, isn't it? Captain de Vlaming comes into that very river in 1600 and something. Does anyone know the actual year? How disgraceful that the people of Perth do not know the actual year.
For shame, Australia.
In he comes and... He sees for the first time this impossible sight, right. A river covered with black swans. And that's why he names that river in Dutch Swan River. It's the first act of European naming for this continent.
Right. And for a concept
of
something that cannot be but is. And
we're in a university that stands on the shores of a river, on the banks of a river, that is the encounter of the European with that which should be impossible but which is not.
Right. Which is also, if you want to get really meta, a pretty good description of life itself. You know, it cannot be and it is. And that's what Alma's all about and that's what the arts are all about. Everything is a black swan. What are we doing? What are any of us doing here? It's weird. But I think we get used to the miraculous. I mean... I think despair begins when the miraculous becomes mundane. And the miraculous becomes mundane when you forget that there is no mundane. That it's all a miracle. It's all a mystery. It's all very deeply, deeply odd and deeply, deeply fascinating.
Now, you didn't emerge fully formed as a writer with Eat, Pray, Love. You've been writing for a long time and you're writing long-form journalism in York very successfully. And the famous fact about you is that you wrote an article for GQ magazine about your experiences working in a pretty raunchy bar on the Lower East Side, which eventually became the basis for a hugely enjoyable movie called Coyote Ugly. And in preparation,
I don't want to brag, but that's me.
In preparation for meeting you at this conversation, I went down to my video store and asked the guy if he had Coyote Ugly, and he said, "Mate, it's very shallow." Because he knows I'm deep. I usually want the arty things.
Did he think, like, Fellini? You thought it was a Fellini film or something?
I mean, he didn't strike me as that deep, the guy who runs the video store. So I thought, wow. Anyway, I enjoyed it hugely. And it's the story of a girl who works in a bar, a sort of dorky girl who arrives in New York and goes and works in this very, very raunchy bar. And the romantic interest in the movie is played by the Aussie song and dance man Adam Garcia. Can you tell us briefly about the incident that gave rise to the film?
Okay, so when I came to New York, back to New York, I went to school in New York and then I went traveling and then I came back after a heartbreak. New York always having been to me the mother's arms. You know, it's a city that people think is very hard, and to me it's always been the most welcoming. Whenever things go wrong in my life, it always takes me back. It's like, come on, get in. What are you knocking on the door at 2 a.m.? We'll let you in. So I got a job working at this skanky bar called the Coyote Ugly Saloon on the Lower East Side, and I loved it. I worked there for about a year and a half. There was just the one of them. It was a lot grosser than the bar in the movie. It was a place with only female bartenders and really only male customers. It was about an inch away from being a strip joint, but it wasn't. It was sort of a good time honky-tonk dance on the bar. When the guys would get in too close, we would pour Bacardi 151 down the bar and set it on fire. To keep ourselves safe. It's an odd thing to do. Strikes me saying that this is maybe a hostile work environment, but it was fun, and it was a great joyful time of my life. It was a libertine time of my life. And then I went on to do other things, and eventually when I was writing for GQ, I wrote a little memoir piece about what that was like, being somebody working in that place.
You know, I'm kicking myself that we didn't get a really pumpy track onto the sound system now and say, come on, Liz, to wind up, show us some of your moves.
You got it. I am not the greatest dancer, but I mean, my role at that bar was always sort of the ironic. I danced on the bar, but ironically.
That would have really come across.
You know, sort of like... You know, we all know I can't do this, but I'm doing it. I was the black swan on the bar, but it was fun and it was liberating. It was a really important part of my life. And you know, I think there's a place in our lives where you should have seasons of abandon, and that was one of them for me. And I wrote about it, and somebody at Disney read it, and they up and made that freaking movie out of it. So strange. And they... What I find fascinating about it is that they said from the beginning, we want this to be a movie for adolescent girls. And I thought, this bar is not a place for adolescent girls to have any... This is a very adult... I mean, it's full of alcoholics and full... I mean, just... They took all the drinking out of the movie. You notice that? It takes place in a bar, but no one ever has a drink.
No, that's very sober.
And then they did it, and it was this huge hit. Anyway, it's very fun. And one of the strangest things for me is, like, I was in Thailand a couple years ago, and they had this big sign, Coyote Ugly Night, at some bar in Bangkok. And I just thought, dear God, what have I done? It's a very funny thing. Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah.
The premiere, all the regulars of the bar who were like the skankiest dirtballs in the entire world, I got 10 seats and I brought all my favorite Redneck Lou, Nazi Dave, that was an ironic nickname, like all the just the regular skanks of the bar, and we all went to see the premiere, the Hollywood premiere, and at the end of it, everybody in the theater filed out except the 10 of them, who just sat there with their arms crossed and their jaws dropped staring at the screen like, what was that? So surreal.
Now as we wind up, you've got a book coming out in September, is that it?
I do, yeah.
It's called Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. Can we know a little of what this is?
Yeah, it's a manifesto. I've always wanted to write a manifesto. It's a really kind of fierce manifesto defending creativity in the arts from the tormented and the professional, and hoping to give it back to the people. And challenging the idea that you can't live a creative life unless you live a tormented life. Trying to bring back sort of joy and humanity and lightness to the creative process, and maybe helping people to work around their own fears about creativity so that we can all become the makers that our shared human lineage wants us to be.
Oh, that's a manifesto I could sign up
for. It's a manifesto.
Would you thank Liz Gilbert?
Thank you.
Liz Gilbert's latest novel is called The Signature of All Things. It's published by Viking. I'm Michael Cathcart saying goodbye from the Perth International Arts Festival.
Thank you.